Welcome to the Hollywood Outsider, an award-winning weekly entertainment podcast. In this episode, we are discussing one topic. Normally, we discuss multiple ones, but this week it's just one topic, and that's the history of movie theaters. How have theaters changed over the years, both in facts and in our own experiences? Let's get on with the show. My name's Aaron Peterson. Joining me today, my fellow host, John Davenport.
Hey, buddy. Hey, buddy.
Hey, buddy. Troy Heinrichs.
Hey, buddy.
Hey, buddy.
Hey, buddy. How about doctor, a bloody buddy?
Doctor. Buddy. Buddy. Buddy.
So the reason we're going to do this particular episode on the history of movie theaters is just because, well, one, news is still pretty light these days with, you know, the way that the strikes have been going. And yeah, they're ramping up and ending and being ratified and everything else, but we're still not getting a lot of news out. And I just thought it'd be interesting to take a look at where we are now versus where we were, where we started. And also just like how impactful that has been and how will Taylor Swift change it all? It's really what it boils down to.
This is the roundabout way of you saying that this is all about Taylor Swift again?
It's always about Taylor Swift, isn't it?
Well, she's changed football all of a sudden.
That'll be over probably by the time you hear this, honestly. let's be honest. She's writing her new album, Offsides, right now. That's what she's working on. That's the next one up. Sorry, Travis.
It's the false start tour.
Exactly.
Track number three, Touchback.
No, but we're going to talk about, well, Taylor Swift, look, I don't care who it is, all right? There's someone who has enough power, who's amassed enough power, however, to walk past the studio doors, not make a deal with them, and make a deal directly with the movie theaters. That's never been done in such a way. So, and especially to such enormous effect, like the overwhelming advanced ticket sales and ticket sales. By the time you hear this, just the ticket sales in general, how much money this movie, this concert film is going to rake in, has never been done before in the history of film. It's changing film. Beyonce is going to have her concert film in December. It's already changing how movie theaters work. And it's fascinating. I don't care if it's Taylor Swift. I don't care if it's Rolling Stones. I don't care if it's Jay-Z. I don't care who it is. It's just fascinating to me that it's, once again, movie theaters are evolving to some other form. That could change. Maybe we start getting Super Bowls in a movie theater. Maybe we start getting big TV series finales in movie theaters. Wouldn't that be amazing? I mean, I know that they had a limited run for Ahsoka. They could do something like that with even bigger properties. There's a lot that could happen. So that's why I just want to go through kind of like the history of movie theaters and where we are and where you guys think we're going, as well as some listener feedback is really interesting in terms of what really has changed their perception of movie theaters over the years.
I guess the big question I have before we get digging into the history is like, why hasn't anybody done the Taylor move before? Like, what stopped them from doing so? Is it that they didn't have enough financial backing to like sport the number of screens that they needed to have, or like
perfect storm? I guess. I mean, let's wait until we get there because we're going to talk about that anyway. That's a great question to ponder. Gives you time to ponder because John does not have an answer for that, not yet, but he will.
I don't even know if I'll be able to think about one.
Okay. All right. So we're going to go through these. Now, we're going to discuss each big moment, but I just kind of want to go through, like, here is where we started with movie theaters. So in 1891, the Edison Company invented the kinetoscope, which allowed one person to watch moving pictures, and by 1894, it was a commercial success. The first to present projected moving pictures to a paying audience were the Lumiere brothers in December 1895 in Paris, France. They used a device of their own, making the cinematograph, which was a camera, a projector, and a film printer all in one. So here's where the moving pictures began in many respects. Do you guys even remember any history on this? Like, do you remember researching this at any point other than this for this podcast? Do you know much about this?
No, I don't think I've actually looked into a lot of this, with the exception of like minor stuff in art school where animation was involved.
Well, I'm so glad John answered the question first then. The Lumiere brothers actually, I thought, really perfected the device from what the Edison company actually had. If the Edison company, when theirs came out, it was actually more like a steel frame and it was like not movable. So it wasn't really useful to do like actual movie film shooting. Plus it didn't have the projection option. When the Lumiere brothers put theirs together, they actually did a couple really great inventions. One is that they actually made it portable so that it could move around like the traditional camera would be done today. They did add the projection element. And what was really great was that they actually thought ahead of the problems that they would have, because the heat source from the lamp, when it was shining through the film, could actually destroy the film. And so they actually made a water goblet that would sit between the light source and the film to dissipate the heat. That way, if the goblet of water broke first, at least the film was still protected. So they really made a lot of technological advancements with non-technological things in order to make what we have in modern cameras today.
John, you really couldn't bring that?
Couldn't bring what?
Silence is golden.
Wow. Well, I hope people are listening for the first time and realizing that they could do better, you know? You could just go do better. All right, well, moving on. Thanks, Troy. That's what I was looking for. That's the kind of facts I wanted. So Troy and I are going to do this from now on. The ability to add color to film was first presented to the public in 1909, but it was done by hand and was not widely used until 1932 when the introduction of the three-color process was introduced. So the advancement of color, this is something that I think is fascinating because it changes how we even look at film. And they still use black and white a lot up until, you know, the 50s and 60s. They would still intermittently use black and white. So color wasn't the standard, I would say, until probably the late 50s, early 60s, because black and white, cheaper, easier to process. So what do you guys think in terms of nowadays when people use black and white, they're using it to kind of take you back in time. And I don't know if that necessarily resonates so much with audiences today as it did 20 years ago, like with Schindler's List, where that really just changed how you saw a film. I don't know if that would work anymore. And it's kind of amazing how we've come that far to where, you know, in the old days, they would actually still go to black and white because they preferred it. It was easier. They understood it was more economical. Now we do black and white and people are like, I don't want to see that. I want color.
Unless you're watching a Kurosawa film and then you're like, absolutely want the black and white.
Well, there's no new Kurosawa films.
That's a problem that somebody should fix.
How would sure, they let's fix go, that? Let's go dig his freaking ass up and make this work again.
How do they fix that?
Someone could actually do a film in the style of Kurosawa. Like it was, they actually did it in a video game, the Ghost of Tsushima, where they actually had a whole Kurosawa way you could play the game in the black and white, and it was fantastic.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
It was so good.
Chad Stahelski is doing that movie, and he's trying very, very hard to, I think, honor that style of film. So I don't know if he's going to try specifically that, but I think he's trying to make it authentically with you know, Japanese spoken dialect and English subtitles. I don't know if that's going to fly with studios, but that's what I think he's trying to do.
It would be amazing if he does, because the game was freaking awesome.
It's a great story. Beautiful story.
But yeah, the color concept, I think, is really interesting because you have to understand a little bit about art and you have to understand a little bit about how the human eye works. Most people would think in art, and our John would correct me if I'm wrong, but they would think that red and blue make purple and blue and yellow make green and all that stuff that we talk about. So they would think that you would use red, blue, and yellow as your primary colors, but the human eye doesn't see it that way. It's actually better to do red, blue, and green based on the gamma rays of the color and how that actually works with light waves. And so that's why the three color system was actually needed in order to make the color really work in film, because the human eye wouldn't be able to capture it the proper way without the three primary colors of the RGB.
That's correct, because light combines color differently than pigment does. So the way you would assume that to work, because a lot of people work in pigment, it does not work the same in light. So that is correct.
All right, let's move on to sound. So this is something that I have a special connection to recently. So sound was incorporated and finally delivered in the first full-length feature of The Jazz Singer in 1927. I think most people know that fact. But here's what you might not know. So Presenting Hitchcock, that's the podcast I do where we went through every single Alfred Hitchcock movie. And a lot of the early Hitchcock movies were talkies, right? And silent films. So we had both of those. So there's a period of film where it was silent with just the orchestra score and things like that. And then there are the talkies. Now, talkies, I think people sometimes misconstrue that to mean that that was when everybody was talking. Not necessarily. Sometimes it's just the track was added to the specific film. It just means there's sound incorporated into the film. Everybody understands that, right? Everybody here?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. While I went back, I've always had an aversion to silent films and the early talkies, the ones where it was really just music and title cards, right? And I've always had an aversion to it. So I go back and I rewatch several of these because of the Alfred Hitchcock podcast. And as I'm watching them, I'm realizing that I'm not being fair, because when you watch it in the perspective of not the modern lens, which I think is pretty common for most people to do. I don't want to watch that. God, that's old. I just want to watch new stuff and things blow up and new special effects. But if you watch it and you think about how just phenomenal this was at the time, the movie takes on its own life in many respects. You just see it through a different eye, I guess. You know, you kind of wake up to what the world was like at the time, and you get real insight into the Depression, into how people perceived male and female relationships in the time. You know, that was way different. There, you go watch the older movies and there are guys just smacking women like it's okay. You know, it's just insane to me how things have changed, and that's good. You know, you get a good feeling of progress. There's a film that I watched, and it's actually from 1937. So there's obviously dialogue. There's people talking, blah, 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 blah. But it has blackface in it. You know, I think in this day and age, you would see that and you would be completely just disgusted and immediately, well, we got to cancel Alfred Hitchcock. But that was okay at the time for some reason. And it just gives you like a different view of the world and how far we've come, how different things are. And I don't think I would have necessarily had as deep an appreciation for the progress we made without going all the way back that 100 years to kind of revisit some of those older films that I had not really thought about in forever, and just got that peek into the times. So I highly recommend people that don't necessarily, you don't like silent films, you don't like those really talkies, you don't want to watch something where it's just orchestra score most of the time. I understand, but I do think it's important if you're a cinephile, if you're a film fan, and if you're just a study of human nature, because it really does open the window to how the world has moved forward.
And what I thought was really interesting in the evolution of sound was the fact that if Edison Group was the ones that introduced us to the kinetoscope, which wasn't able to do the projection, then the projection comes over from the Lumiere brothers. But they didn't actually give up on the Edison side. Edison actually also made what was called the kinetophone, and the kinetophone was part of the kinetoscope, but again, it was a single viewing experience. And so the biggest challenge with getting to the talkies was specifically because of the fact that they didn't have synchronization. How do I take the recording of the audio, which you could play on a phonograph, and then make sure that it plays at the exact same speed and rate as the actual moving picture? And that's one of the things that Edison finally broke through on and developed something that was very similar to the apparatus known as the kinetophone, but instead it was basically a way to take the phonograph and tie it with a pulley system to the actual film projector. And that's how they actually got sound and picture to then connect and make the synchronization happen. And then ever since then, we're able to go and have the talking pictures that we know today.
One of the things that I love from this era is actually paying attention to what passed for special effects back then. You know, when you sit there and look at the differences in how they shot things, because what they did is they decided that they understood that there's not a lot of depth perception happening in a film because you only have one eye that you're looking through. And because of that one eye that you're looking through, you have the ability of layering images over what you're shooting so that it looks like one thing. There's, I believe it's a Buster Keaton shot that's pretty famous, where it looks like he's going to dive into this this hole that takes him through a building. But when you pull back and you look at the entire scene of what it actually is, it's him standing on the ledge of absolutely nothing. There's a floor in front of him, but between him and the camera is a matte painting. And that matte painting was done so expertly that it looked like it was an actual place that he was thinking about jumping into, which carries through cinema for decades. One of the things that people don't realize about what you're looking at in the original Star Wars movies are matte paintings in the background, the Bespin factories and Empire Strikes Back. Those are all matte paintings that you're seeing in the background. There's no green screen. It's not happening to the extent that it's happening, that it happens today. You're looking at something where a guy took a paintbrush to a giant canvas and painted out every little thing there in hand. The same thing with some of those scenes with all the stormtroopers. It's just a beautiful lost art to think about when it comes to what they did to make special effects work the way they did, and to the level in which everyone had their hands in it to make it happen.
And they had that way back in, 20s, 30s, 40s. I mean, revisiting all these films, I'm telling you, I've seen so many examples of, that's a special effect. And obviously I can tell now, but at the time that was probably magical. And there's actually been a few that I've seen where I was just very impressed. Like, this is 1940, this is 1950. And it looks pretty stellar, and it's a special effect. Like, I can tell that this is a matte painting, or I can tell this is a backdrop, but it's better than Expendables 4. I can tell you that.
Part of it is that the equipment we're watching it on today does a lot to ruin it for you in a lot of ways.
That perfect clarity really brings it to life.
Because the thing is that film is inherently in HD. So when they turn around and they're like, okay, well, we're going to remaster all this stuff so it's brand new again, you're seeing it in HD, because again, film inherently does that. And what we saw growing up on our televisions, or what we saw on the screen, was just what technology can do in the way of reproduction and the way of distribution and all that other stuff to make sure that it was cost effective. But nowadays, we're seeing crystal clear, as if you're standing in the room with stuff, and you could see in Clash of the Titans that there's an actual screen that they're standing in front of that has a movie being projected on it. That sort of stuff is incredible.
But in the movie, that's one thing that's lost, I think, on modern audiences who see a lot of the stuff we grew up on, or the stuff that our parents grew up on, etc., on a TV screen. You feel like, well, that's just, how could you have enjoyed this? It's painfully obvious. We didn't have the effects you have now, so it looked amazing. Pegasus looked amazing back then. Mm-hmm. And even in the 30s and 40s, and which is the kind of in the 20s, that era, if you would have seen it when those things came out, they looked amazing, as amazing as they could. To them, this was all new. It's basically just like when people first discovered Jurassic Park, or when they first saw Endgame, or the special effects in Endgame, things like that. Like, that all, it felt just like that experience for you.
That's right.
So that's the way you really should look at it, and try to come to a realization of how movie theaters have changed over the
years. Ray Harryhausen was not a household name for no reason.
Right. So, yeah. Did a lot of magical work.
He did a lot of magical work, and his work is still on display out there somewhere. I've got to figure out where it is, though, because that stuff is great.
I'm sure you can Google it.
The one thing that's really interesting about records is that records actually own their ability to the sound era as well. Because if you ever wondered why you have like 78 beats per 78 rotations per minute, 45 rotations per minute, and 33 and a third, the 33 and a third actually comes because there was a company, Western Electric, part of AT&T, and when they tried to figure out how to make sound better for movies. So it was actually, that's what made the standard disc basically 16 inches in diameter, rotating at that 33 and a third, because it actually aligned to the standard 1,000 feet, 300 meters of 35 millimeter film. So the reel of film matched perfectly with the roundness of the record if it spun at that 33 and a third RPMs at 16 inches in diameter. So that was cool that the record actually owns its like history to the movies, if you will.
That's interesting. All right, so let's move on to the golden age of cinema, which began in the 30s when audiences were desperate to escape the Great Depression. And I find that most intriguing, because now I almost feel like there are filmmakers such as, Scorsese, who love to just trash escapism cinema. as that's not cinema. We've heard that from him in particular multiple times, but I've heard that from cinema snobs, I'd like to call them, people that think that there's only one kind of movie you can enjoy, people that I don't agree with. But hey, like whatever you like, that's fine. Just don't hate. Just don't be negative to other people that like other things. There's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with escapism cinema. And it has been cinema for over 100 years. So I just thought that was important to point out, because movies have always been an attempt to escape reality. For me, for millions and millions of other people. Now, there is an art to many films. There is definitely a level of intellect built into certain kinds of films, but there are all kinds of films. And since the golden age of cinema, Scorsese, which was in the 30s around the Depression, people have been going to the theater to escape the problems that they deal with on a regular basis. And if you look at the last 4 years, lots of problems. Of course, people are going to lean toward real escapism and not want to go back. They don't want to watch a documentary on COVID. You know, I don't think that makes them less intellectual or makes filmmakers weak or lazy. I think they're making things that people want to see. Whether you enjoy them, whoever you are, or not, remains to be seen. But that is what is happening. And I just thought I would mention this, and I think it's an interesting topic, that don't we hear that a lot from people that feel more comfortable with a certain kind of film, that escapism is not real cinema?
I mean, cinema to me is the definition of the technique of creating whatever art you use in order to, you know, pass light through a camera, to capture it on film, to attach audio, to use different effects and techniques in order to make the film stand out and pop in the way it needs to do. So how I perceive the film has nothing to do with the art of the film creation. So escapism is a feeling, not an actual art form. So therefore it can be film.
Wouldn't it be the eye of the beholder, right?
Exactly.
It's all of it's wildly subjective. You've got somebody like Scorsese.
Yeah, that's how you say it. It's much, much more ominous that way.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, I just
call him Marsco or Buds.
Yeah.
Hashtag Marsco. Trademark.
And we lost John.
Sorry, John. Is that Marsco?
Can we order a whole bunch of monogram jackets for him so that he can feel warm and fuzzy
to him? Yeah,
yeah.
That way, everybody that wants a tweet that he doesn't like about it, they could just hashtag
Marsco. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God. Okay. So just like any other art form, cinema is subjective, and you know, whatever the reason why people are enjoying it is the reason why they're going to the theater. Right. So if you are somebody who's a quote unquote cinephile and you're going to these movies that are art pieces of art that are meant to be pieces of art, then you're escaping into that. But the people who don't find that easy, who want something more accessible, something that takes them even further out there than what it is they're looking at, they're going to go to the more accessible artwork, right? They're going to go to books. They're going to go to comic books, or they're going to go to whatever it is that is out there that creates a story in which they can fall into and be in a wonderland of magic and heroes and whatever it is they want to do. Whenever I hear somebody say that cinema, you know, the films today aren't cinema, or, you know, cinema is only a certain kind of film, I just smile and nod and let them have their way, because apparently they have their thoughts. It's just like the same people who walk in the MoMA, which is the Museum of Modern Art in New York, and sit there and say, this is what real artwork is. You know, things like a toilet that's been knocked over and somebody signs it and puts a couple of other knickknacks on it. That's artwork, because it's supposed to be triggering some sort of thought. You got a Pollock sitting on the wall that, though his color theory and color techniques are something to marvel at, to the common eye, it looks like it's just paint splatter on a canvas when, he just threw paint up against a wall and it stuck, which is not the technique he used, but it doesn't really matter because overall people won't appreciate it the same as somebody else. So again, all subjective, But the people who seem to think that they have the ability of forcing their opinion on one another are the ones that just annoy me the most. Is that us? Wait, is that us? Do we form first?
No, I think we're open-minded. We like Michael Bay just as much as we like, you know, Chris Marsco? Nolan and not Wes Anderson. Yeah, Marsco. Just as much as Marsco.
It's funny.
Is he a cop?
I could see that. Yeah, he's a grizzled detective trying to solve the big case. But uh-huh. He only solves real cinema cases. He won't right. solve escapism cinema cases. I don't know where I was going.
Marsco.
Hashtag Marsco.
And I think the reason why it was called the Golden Age of Cinema was because there was like a really great period towards the end of the Depression, right before the World War II started, where 1939 is actually one of the best years of cinema, because 5 of the movies made that year actually end up on AFI's top 100 movie list. And those would be Wizard of Oz, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Stagecoach, and Wuthering Heights. So those all came out in 1939.
So did Gone with the Wind, brother.
I'm sorry, Miss Gone with the Wind. Yes, that was
how did you
5.
Forget that?
Gone with the Wind, Wizard of Shame Oz, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Stagecoach, Wuthering Heights.
Gone 5. With the Wind is cinema.
I can't count.
What? I don't think you can watch it anymore without a disclaimer.
Right, exactly.
Because we're not old enough to understand that this happened, you know, like 80 years ago.
And then at the on the other side of it, towards the end of the war in 1951, it's another great year with 1951 having African Queen, Streetcar Named Desire, An American in Paris, and A Place in the Sun. So that 10-year period during the war is like really when people came out to the movies and just really embraced Hollywood. And it doesn't really pick up again until the 70s.
Escapism, right?
Mm-hmm.
Escapism. Things were tough. And in the 1950s, movie theaters had their first real big challenge, like as home TVs began emerging as a changing of the scenery. And it's funny to me because I've heard this multiple times in my lifetime. Movie theaters are dead. VHS came out. Movie theaters are dead. When I was a kid, DVD came out. Movie theaters are dead. We got cable. Cable really exploded. We got cable TV. We had sexy cable shows, like just all kinds of sexy cable shows. And
Red Shoe Diaries.
Movie theaters are dead. And then, you know, of course, streaming, movie theaters are dead. No matter what, I feel like those are people that just don't want to go to the movie theater. And that's fine. Hey, whatever you're happy with. But they seem to keep finding a way. Just like life, movie theaters find a way. It's amazing to me to think this has been going on since the 50s, where movie theaters have been basically declared as a dying format, where they just keep getting reinvented in different ways.
And if you really think about it, you talk about escapism, the television in the 1950s, the biggest you could get was a 16-inch television. It took them almost 20 years to get it up to 25 inches.
Can you imagine cramming your whole family around that?
Yeah, you're
getting close, kids.
Yeah, we're watching Streetcar Named Desire on a 16-inch TV.
Can't even see the streetcar.
Or the desire.
I mean, you need the kids up front so they can change channel for you.
That's true. Oh, man. It just reminds me when I was a kid when I had the remote with the cable on it. Remember that?
Mm-hmm. Like, oh, God.
God forbid you actually walked over it and stepped on it and broke it. Jesus.
That big, like, clicky cable box thing where everything is labeled a certain way.
Oh, God. It's so funny. All right. Well, that leads us to our next big change. And that was 1968. Ratings were introduced. And they've changed throughout the years. In fact, didn't we do a ratings episode where we just talked about ratings? Yeah.
Yeah, we did. Invention of PG-13, I believe it was.
Yeah. It was a great episode, I think. Go listen to it. But ultimately, we still use these as a guide to determine how saucy a particular film is for other people. PG-13 was added in 1985. And that remains the most significant change of our era, except for, you could say, the TV ratings, but we're talking about movie theaters, so that doesn't matter. We're talking about movie theaters and movie ratings. So what do you think about that? Do you feel like in today's environment, we still need ratings, or do we just need to know what's in the movie?
I mean, don't we actually, I think it's hard. It's like saying, what's in my food? And we have food labels on everything. So I want to know what's in the food, but I also like, no, I like Frosted Flakes and I like Fruit Loops and I don't care what's in it. It tastes good.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So if I see a trailer for a movie, I'm like, I'm going to go watch that movie. So I don't need the ratings. The ratings, I think, are a way to just make sure people aren't exposed to content that they shouldn't see at an early age.
Just for families, right?
Yeah, it's really a guide for kids. And honestly, it's like, even though Common Sense Media is a more religious based run organization, I think Common Sense Media does a really great job because it does the thing that most places don't do, which is takes the opinion of the parents, takes the opinion of the critics, and also takes the opinion of the kids and say, like, this is the general assumption, because I think we also, as regulation agencies, border on too safe sometimes, even with food and drug and whatnot. Like, the, you know, little extra factor probably isn't that big of a deal. So getting some more realistic perspectives on mm-hmm. what these things could be. Like, I have a very mature 16-year-old. He could probably handle most TVMA without a problem. You know, daughter, on the other hand, probably couldn't have handled TVMA at 16. So, you know, in that regard, I think it's really a matter of, like you said, like, I just need to know, like, what's in the movie, because even now I feel like the TVMA is so blurred, because, like, TVMA meant sex, right? Like, you're mm-hmm. going to see sex, and now you don't even see sex. You see simulated sex in a TVMA, but they still put sexual content as the title. And that makes it TVMA. Like, it's not really TVMA. It's like, it's no different than TV-14. Cause then you go look at what's on network TV and go, wow, that's really TVMA. They put a dude through a wood chipper on the blacklist. It's like, that should be TVMA. I see worse killings on Breaking Bad, you know?
Ratings, I think, are more accurate for the most part, except for they have the whole language thing, which that's a whole other podcast we already did. But language is, I think, subjective as well.
I think the rating system has its place, and it works for the people who are, let's call it, more sensitive to what they're seeing in a movie. But I know people who are so dependent upon those TV ratings, because, or not the TV ratings, the movie ratings. Fuck TV. We're not talking about that right
exactly.
now.
Exactly.
Troy. That was a dig at Troy.
Fully accept it. Appreciate it.
So, but I know people who need those to be able to make it through a movie, or decide they're going to go to a movie because they don't want to subject themselves to things that they don't agree with. So they're not going to go to a PG-13 movie because they don't agree with whoever's cursing in the movie. They're not going to go to an R rating movie because they don't want to see boobies or whatever else that could possibly show up in the movies, or the killing, or any of those other things. But they'll go to a PG or even G because that makes them feel safe, and that makes them feel comfortable, and that actually fits into who they are as a person and what their beliefs are. So I think it's necessary. It's a good way for people to decide what they're going to watch based off of what they see in trailers, and on top of that, what they see in the ratings. And I think it's something that we do need.
All right, well, moving on, the next big change came into focus in the 1970s with the blockbuster era. And it began, and obviously that's also when cinema began, according to Martin Scorsese. but also, it began with Jaws, a movie that made hundreds of millions of dollars in the summer. And before that was commonplace. So if you look at it the way the world is today, we all think summer's blockbuster season. Now, granted, that has changed a lot with the way TV's evolved, the way movie theaters have evolved. But back then, summers were not the place where people went to the movie theater, because what do? They went out, they had fun, they went outside, they went camping, they didn't go to the theater. Well, this changed. So basically, this formerly dead season is now the most lucrative time of the year. So people came to love movie theaters once again to escape, only this time, you know, the hot rays of summer.
And hot they were. I mean, people, we talk about climate change, and climate change is a real thing. I'm not dissing on climate change, but there were definitely hotter summers even back then in the 70s, and especially when you think about the issues they were having with, like, the gas crisis and everything that was going on there, it was just hard for people to get around. So they needed some place to go and congregate, and the movie theater is a great way to do it, to get that free air conditioning.
True. I mean, that's a factor. But I also think, you know, we had more of a sense of community in many respects before we had all of this available content at our fingertips. And that sense of community built through movie theaters. And I think it started in the 70s for sure, but it really just got amplified in the 80s with blockbusters and just having that communal experience. I mean, I think some of my best memories still to this day were as a kid going to a movie theater with lines and lines of people. And you think Nowadays, people get so aggravated with inconvenience, but that was exciting back then.
Mm-hmm.
It was just so thrilling because we weren't so impatient, number one. And we also didn't have a million other things to do because we didn't have smartphones. We didn't have streaming. We didn't have a million things to do. So we could be excited for what we were going to see. And we knew nobody was going to ruin it with their phone. And people had more respect back then, so they didn't talk. So all these factors, I think, just made for, you know, from the 70s to the early 2000s, probably one of the, like, just the most exciting time I can imagine for movie theater experiences.
Plus, it gave you the greatest canvas for movies, too, because, you know, with 69 and the moon landing, you're now looking at, oh, there's this whole space. What is space stuff? Let's make space stuff. And then we get things like, you know, Battlestar, and we get Star Wars and Star Trek. And it's like, this is amazing time to be in movies because the imaginative boundary of where you can go mm-hmm. has just shifted enormously because of the space race happening in the early 70s, late 60s into early 70s.
Wasn't that just a movie? I thought it was all faked.
Yeah, that was all fake. I mean, it never happened.
It was the test for Star Wars.
It was the screen test. We did a special effects test. We just got like Neil Armstrong to come down and do a little. We just need a person in the shot, if you could.
All right, now say this.
That's amazing. Does it bother either one of you that we still have this blockbuster era? Like, it's still, we're going to talk about the mega blockbuster, but the fact that, you know, blockbusters came out and kind of changed how people go to the movies, does that bother you? Or do you feel the same way I do, that that was an exciting period of your life and it also was a communal experience?
My best memories from going to the movies all happened in the 90s and the early 2000s, where it used to be a communal thing. Groups of friends would go to the movie theaters to go see things, and we would go stand in line or we would go hang out at the movie theater because of whatever reason. I was just reminiscing with an old friend of mine, and she and I used to go to the movies all the time, and I remember every single moment of those trips to the movies were each and every one magical and fun because of the kind of experience we had. So I think these days we are robbed of that whole magic. You know, it's just not the same thing as it used to be because everything is a problem.
Yeah, I mean, blockbusters are amazing. I just wish today's age we didn't have to think in terms of like hundreds of millions of dollars to make a blockbuster.
Yeah.
I mean, John and I talked about it a few weeks ago, right? With the mm-hmm. creator only costing mm-hmm. $80 million. That could be easily a summer blockbuster type movie in a heartbeat because of how awesome it was and the effects and the story and everything. If it gets released in July, but it doesn't, it gets released in October and it's no longer a blockbuster.
And it didn't do very well.
And I think it's just, again, it goes back to marketing at the end of the day. So a lot of things with marketing really decide whether or not something is going to become a blockbuster. I don't even think it has to be in the summer. I just think we have this like preconceived notion that blockbusters only happen in the summer. And I think that's something that we need to change as part of the next evolution of movie theaters as we move into the 2020s and 2030s.
I mean, I think it's been shown over and over. It just takes a property that people get excited about. It, Chapter One, when that came out, it came out in September, and I think it was Labor Day weekend or first weekend after that, something, I don't remember exactly. I think it was September 7th or something like that. But when that came out, movies around Labor Day always flop. Like they were like the Jason Statham of releases and stuff like that, you know. That's just the way that it was. Transporter 8, shit like that. And then that came out and it just blew everybody away. It had a massive opening. People got excited. Chapter 2 came out. That did well too. You had Deadpool, which I think opened in February, and that did bonkers business. We've had massive blockbusters in March now. We're getting October. They've had massive, you know, horror films for years in that. But so it happens all throughout the year now. It's not just a certain month. It just has to be a property that people get excited about.
Right.
And that's the trick. It's finding a property that people get excited about. And also, you know, we've talked about it on the show, and I know a lot of people love to comment on Twitter and everywhere else, right? Whenever a new property is getting rebooted, that, God, Hollywood, they have no new ideas. And this isn't new. This has been said in every freaking message form since they invented message forms. Hollywood has no new ideas. They're just remaking the same stuff. But when new original stuff comes out and we don't go see it in the movie theater, what happens? It flops. And then you don't see much more of that thing.
Which is why we need to get more of that thing to do the Taylor maneuver so that we can bypass
the
studios.
Maybe that's the answer. Maybe that's the answer. I don't know. Okay, so streaming impacted theaters next, right? Beginning with YouTube on February 14th, Valentine's Day, 2005. And then Netflix on January 16th, 2007, was followed by numerous other services like Hulu and the rest of them. And we're all familiar with that trend. But as COVID has weakened and streaming has kept inching up on its pricing, movie theaters have continued on, even reinventing what that means with performers such as Taylor Swift and Beyonce making those moves to reinvigorate cinema in their own way. So once again, I come back to movie theaters are dead. They didn't. They came back. Now, they came pretty close to dying. I'm not going to lie. There was a period in 2020 where I thought movie theaters might be it. We might be down to just, you know, a couple hundred across the nation, and that didn't happen. And everybody loves to say, well, what saves cinema? It's been a lot of movies. It isn't one. It isn't Barbie. It isn't the closest one I can say that saves cinema is probably Spider-Man No Way Home, because that one came out and proved that we can still make a ton of money with these movies. And then all the horror movies that have come out that still managed to make money during COVID, because horror fans don't care. We're obviously not scared. So
I think
we just keep going.
People don't understand about movie theaters is that they only have the perspective of what a movie theater is today. Movie theaters used to be theaters. Like, they used to be actual theaters where you would see theatrical Broadway play musical type productions that then just added a screen to them so that you can see the movies displayed at the theater.
Yeah, go either way that way.
Right. And so movie theaters themselves didn't need to be saved because they're not movie theaters. They're exhibition houses.
Oh my God. All right. You just had to spend all that time to get a technicality in. Is that what just happened?
That's the thing. Movie theaters have to figure out a way today with the competition that we have because of YouTube and Netflix and other streaming services to do things that are now exhibition houses. So let's exhibit concert films. Let's exhibit Super Bowl. Let's exhibit an episode of Ahsoka. Not in one theater. Make it available everywhere, because damn it, I'm not driving to the one theater in Chicago that's willing to do this stuff. Mm-hmm. Like I think movie theaters have to stop getting in their own way also and take some of these steps in order to become more what they are, which is exhibition houses that literally show movies, but also show some other stuff too. And I think they would actually, the advent of the rent out a theater with all your buds and your brides and your best mans and whatever and parties for $99 to see an old film. Like, we did that for Christmas Vacation with like 20 of our friends. It was amazing.
Yeah, it's a great time.
That's the kind of stuff they need to do to just keep that square footage space full.
Agreed. 1,000%. Hey, we're going to come back to the history of movie theaters real quick. I want to introduce the trailer for our new podcast. It's sponsored by The Hollywood Outsider, inspired by a true story. It's an idea that's been in my head for a very, very long time. It's essentially true crime mixed with movies. You're going to like it if you really take the time to go listen. You can subscribe now. It's in your podcast feeds. And be sure to share it with any friends that you have. I mean, that would be greatly appreciated. It's a brand new podcast. It's so hard to break through anymore. There's like a bazillion out there. But I am very, very proud of what we've done here. And we've got a couple episodes out now. Cocaine Bear's coming. Scream's coming. Monster's coming. Catch Me If You Can is coming. There's a lot of movies that are coming. And you might be surprised about the details behind what inspired those particular movies. I know there's a few that took me by real surprise. Check out Inspired by a True Story. Here's the trailer. We all love true crime and the movies they inspire, but have you ever wondered how true that story actually is? Welcome to Inspired by a True Story, where every 2 weeks our award-winning podcast hosts and film critics discuss the genuine details that have inspired some of the most memorable true crime movies around. Each episode will break down the crime or crimes that inspired a very specific film, and then discuss how factual that film is versus how much is simply Hollywood magic. Inspired by a True Story is now available to listen and subscribe on your favorite podcast app, or you can always find episodes at inspiredbyatruestory.com. As fans, we all deserve to know how true our true crime is. So take a listen to Inspired by a True Story, and let's keep those artists honest. I know everyone is sick of hearing the name Taylor Swift. I get it. I mean, it's not her fault that she's as popular as she is, but I get it. But that idea we're going to come back to. But I want to talk about the final big change, which was around 2010 when the mega blockbuster began to really take shape. And Hollywood Economics began to move away from low to mid budget fare to properties with massive budgets and even larger global returns. It became very much a global industry. And that's been going on a little bit before 2010, but really Marvel kind of amped it up when they started making their billion-dollar franchises. There's been a few other ones too, Pirates of the Caribbean stuff. Disney's been very good about creating and crafting billion-dollar franchises. Harry Potter, obviously, is another one. But after COVID, many have come to believe that indie films can no longer survive in a mega blockbuster market except on streaming. And I've always been an advocate for, I want to see both movies and movies. There's nothing I love more than going to a movie every single week. And I do. I go every single week to a movie in a movie theater. I prefer movies over TV shows. It's my preference. I want a story that actually ends and doesn't get canceled by some dickhead in a suit. So I want to see how something ends. And I love a movie theater experience. To me, it's just a nostalgia. It's my happy place, whatever. That's where I want to be when I enjoy my entertainment. And, you know, I don't care about the mega blockbuster market. I mean, that's great. Make them. People want to see them. I don't think you can really sit there and just keep poo-pooing it because you don't like it. If you don't like it, it's fine. But other people love them. But I do wish more people would take on A-List or something along those lines. Regal, every theater house has this now where they have some kind of all you can see pass. You know, you pay $25 a month or $30 a month and you can see all the movies you want. Go see your mega blockbuster. And then the next week, go see an independent movie. Go see something you would challenge yourself. See something you wouldn't normally see. I wish more people would do that. I do think that is dying in many respects and being replaced by I stumbled upon it on streaming. What say you?
I 100% agree with that point of view as far as people aren't willing to go to the theater anymore unless they have some way of proving that they're going to have a good experience. They don't want to take the risk and then go see something that might not be to their liking. They don't want to take the risk to give up that time to something that they hear on the internet is bad. Even from trusted friends, they'll sit there and turn away suggestions for movies and TV shows justified and not sit there.
Nice. Two digs at Troy.
But you know, even for trusted friends, I've told the story before where I've had a conversation about a movie and I'm like, yeah, no, the movie was good. I really enjoyed it. There's a little wobbles here and there, but you know, it's still overall a good sit. And the response would be like, well, I heard it was terrible from these strangers on the internet, so I think it's going to be terrible. No, I saw the movie. It's not terrible. If you know, it wobbles maybe, but it works. Oh no, it's terrible because these people on X or Twitter or whatever it is it's called these days all said it's terrible. You know, I've found my ability to trust these mass voices on the internet is lessening because it's, you know, you hear stories these days about how things are movies and TV shows are being review bombed left and right. And yeah. So how can you trust the internet anymore? How can you trust that these voices on the internet are telling you the right story? You know, we're all too afraid to experience something for ourselves without that. And I think it's sad.
My favorite is when people say that, well, you know, critics are all bought and paid for. I'm like, when? I've been waiting for my check for a long time.
Man, I am about to be able to afford that newspaper I always wanted.
Sweet, great one. Right when they're in style.
Right. You know?
I think there was probably one last big change, though, too, which was probably in that 18 to 20 range of 2018 to 2020. That was both the introduction of MoviePass and A-List and things of that nature, because it solved the problem that John was talking about taking a chance on a film.
Sure.
Like now I can go to 3 movies a week and I don't care what it is. I just want to make sure I'm getting my value out of the $25 a month I'm paying for A-List or $23.99, whatever it is. Don't quote me. It's more than 20, less than 30, which is still less than the original movie pass, which was $40.
And it does depend on back in the day. It does depend on your market. So you wouldn't get it right all across the board anyway.
But I think the big thing that's going to be the most interesting thing to watch is going to be the disillusion, I think is the right word, for the Paramount decree, which basically, if you remember back in the 40s, Paramount Pictures basically got sued and said you can't actually own movie theaters and show your own stuff in it because it'd be antitrust. Well, now they're saying that there's so many companies that the companies themselves could own their own movie theaters. So when you think about it, and it's funny because in that decree, it actually said that Paramount Pictures could not own exhibition houses. To go back to my point earlier.
Oh, Jesus Christ. This is all to connect to that. I got it.
But the big thing there is that what happens when Apple buys a movie theater or Disney buys a movie theater or Peacock or Comcast buys a movie theater? I think that's going to be very interesting to see how that would play out over the next 10 years, because I think that could be a major monumental shift, especially in how we're thinking about could Taylor Swift buy movie theaters and just buy screens in order to say, like, I'm going to buy as many screens as I possibly can to show my stuff.
Right.
I think that's a very interesting concept that the Paramount disillusion basically allowed happen is we can buy and own whatever we want now, which is interesting.
Hold on. I got a really good Tim Cook impression right now. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
Welcome to the Apple Movie Theater, the movie theater that's going to bring you the best, the very best of every experience. Apple is going to introduce the one thing that's going to make these movies the better than any other movie theater is going to be able to do this. It's popcorn.
Oh, what?
Because it's not popcorn we've had before. It's we've taken the time to learn and how to make popcorn even better than the rest of everybody else.
Right.
I know that was a concern since that was dissolved.
It takes time, and they're coming out of the pandemic still.
I don't think they're going to do that, though. They have to consistently benefit from it in order to do it. Now, I could see someone of maybe Google or Apple size do something like that because they have money to just blow. Like, it's gone.
Right.
Disney has a lot of money, but they don't have Apple money. You know, Warner Brothers has a lot of money. They don't have Apple money. So I don't think it's necessarily going to happen.
Here's where the straw hits the camel's back, because there's conversations that Disney is looking at selling off ABC. So you take the cash influx from selling off your TV arm of your business so you can focus on the movie part of your business, and then you take that and purchase a bunch of movie theaters with that influx of cash. I mean, it's a conspiracy theory, I know, but...
No, I mean, there's some value there. They don't do anything unless they're going to make a fortune off of it. And I can't see any way that they make a fortune off that. I don't see how that... The only advantage is to someone like an Apple who has a streaming service that doesn't do very well, but has very, very well-received products on it. So I could see them doing that to give a bigger canvas to the works that they have and doing something where they incorporate their TV shows, they incorporate their movies, and they just, you know, that I could see. Disney, I don't see them doing. I just don't see how they benefit from that. They would have to have so many theaters to make it worth their while, and they would have to have consistent mega blockbuster after mega blockbuster. And they're struggling with that right now.
And the Apple Theater, the Apple iBeacon and Apple Tags basically detect your phone on the Find My network and basically make your phone inoperable for the run of the movie.
Oh, now you're turning me on. Yeah. Now you got me.
That's pretty hot.
That's sexy.
I mean, people would be mad and they would protest it because how dare you ruin their device for the time of the movie. However, it still would be pretty hot.
Right.
However, they're still going to buy the USB-A to USB-C to lightning dongle for $20.
I hate when dongle. But speaking of hot, let's get back to the hottest act apparently in music right now, who is potentially fundamentally changing how we see movie theaters. Now, what's funny is I think movie fans have talked about this forever. Like, we've wanted big events at movie theater. I know Troy and I've talked about this every year. Can we get the Super Bowl at a movie theater? This would be freaking awesome. You just have food and people can actually, it's okay to eat in this particular venue or something like that, or eat, you know, their snacks, and you can talk during this one because it's a Super Bowl and you want that communal experience. That sounds fantastic to me. Why aren't we doing stuff like this? Taylor Swift, for people that don't realize, or I can't remember if we explained it at the beginning, but rather than go through a studio and have a studio produce her concert film, which means that she's going to have to give the studio X number of dollars, rather than doing that, she went directly to theater chains and made a deal with them to release her film that way. So she's getting the money directly to her. Beyonce doing the same thing, working that same kind of deal up. So Do you think this could change, like Troy's alluding to, the exhibition houses, aka movie theaters, to evolve to not just show movies, but really do massive events, do World Cup soccer, do, you know, hockey championships, basketball, NBA finals, things like that, things that get people excited and they want a communal experience again.
Yeah. Could you imagine like a whole wing? Like we have this at the AMC that I go to, there's a whole wing on one side and a whole wing on the other side. And then the four IMAX Dolby Cinemas are in the middle by the concession stand. But I'm just picturing like the entire wing on the right side. And like every Final Four contest is up on a screen and you can just walk in and out of each, you buy a pass for the day and you can just go and watch whatever game you want to watch and you bounce between the theaters, come and go, pick a seat, doesn't matter, go get some grub at the concession stand. Movie theaters would make a killing
fill the afternoon.
Final Four, especially those first four, round one and round two, where the games run all day. You'd make a killing doing that.
And you know what? You've got a lot of theaters that are being used for two or four seats because the movies are played out, whatever. And instead put in those sporting events, you know, get people, because people love that kind of stuff. And it's not just sporting events. There's a lot of different things they could do. And I just love the innovativeness that she showed. You know, she wasn't going to waste time going, and maybe this was her like supporting the strike movement, or maybe that's why she was going to bypass the studios. Like, I'm not going to go do that because then I'm kind of shortchanging someone else. Maybe, I don't know. I don't know her personal intent. All I know is it's a shrewd business move that could open the door for stuff we wanted to see happen at movie theaters for a long time. And I don't want, granted, I'm sure some people are probably like, we don't want to hear that ruckus coming from another theater. Well, that's, you know, your theater should have some sound protection for that because they blast movies and you shouldn't hear most of it. So same idea.
Think about Monday Night Football. Monday Night Football is huge, right? But not everybody watches Monday Night Football because you're the only one to watch your team that's on. So let's say, you know, the Bears and the Packers are playing on Monday Night Football. Like, imagine the market movie theaters would be able to take in for a Monday night game if they had 6, 7, 8 showings on a Monday night, because Monday night's usually a dead night for the theater. Mm-hmm. Like, put Monday Night Football on. I would much rather go to the movie theater. The movie theater has a bar. The movie theater sells pretzels. The movie theater sells chicken. Movie theater sells pizza. Movie theater sells popcorn. Like, I am set for a Monday Night Football game to sit there for 3 hours rather than sitting on a hard stool in a pub where everybody's just overly loud and you can't hear what's actually going on in the first place.
Sure.
You know, I've often talked about the theater that I love the most around here, which is a sit down and eat kind of theater. And I think about the idea of showing these sorts of events on at that theater and how they have a wait staff. They take your order. You know, you can go and order whatever you want, a candy, an actual burger that tastes like it was done by a really good chef and not some kid behind the counter who has a runny nose, you know, stuff like that. That is just pretty impressive in the way of what they can do. They'll bring you beer. Beer is important, especially if you're going to sit down and watch a game. They'll bring you wine. For some people, that's important too. They'll bring you mixed drinks. All that is a great way for these theaters to evolve into being able to serve a certain group of people in which they're going to the theater to see games. That would be great. If they're going to the theater to see television shows, okay, so you're back in the movie realm where you don't really want to interrupt in the middle of the theater. But if you're showing a couple episodes of a television show back to back, that would be like the last three episodes of Ahsoka. That would be pretty cool as far as an experience is concerned. And I'm sure a lot of people would enjoy that. There's a lot of things that theaters can do that would be able to help them evolve into being able to serve more people. But what I think the most important aspect is to improve upon concessions so that A, they're making more money off of their concessions by delivering better quality, and B, having more options.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just even thinking, you know, when you think Taylor Swift kind of money, and maybe that's what she was able to sidestep and everything. The NFL has such ungodly amounts of money that the NFL would be prime to make a deal, because if Amazon has the rights to Thursday Night Football and the Sunday Ticket is with YouTube, but they don't air the Monday Night Game, you know, like, take the Monday Night Game and just sell it to AMC, you know, or at least regionally somehow sell it to AMC, so that when that team is on, you know, those AMC theaters in that region benefit from that. And same thing, 55-45 split that Taylor's getting.
And I think there's other ways that they expand it too. You know, I just had this experience. Okay, I was looking, and don't hate me, I love Chris Isaak. For whatever reason, I love his music. It makes me calm. Maybe because it's sad music, and sad music makes me calm. But I was looking at getting concert tickets, and they were like $180 for tickets. I'm like, look, I like you, Chris Isaak. I do not like you $400 worth on a holiday weekend or whatever it was.
$800 minimum to go, minimum to start to go see U2 at the Sphere.
Right. Isn't that insane? So do
insane.
So think of concert. There's so many people that would love to see those shows and they can't, like Taylor Swift, right? So now they get to see her big concert. Do the same kind of thing, but do it more like live. So you get to have the experience. Okay, they're playing in Chicago. Well, all those suburbs necessarily can't make it out. So you do, if you, hey, you're ended up watching the screen from the freaking stadium anyway. So if you're, I'm sure they're going to say like, you can't do it in certain areas where they're performing because that would necessarily, that would kind of cancel each other out, right? They want to make money from selling out a tour, but have theaters in very rural areas or something like that, or just the outskirts or all across the rest of the country that can actually see that concert live, or a comedian stand up like Dave Chappelle. You know, you can see him at the movie theater, you can see his show, and you're getting part of that live experience to some degree. I think that would be like exciting, innovative ways to kind of evolve movie theater. And don't get me wrong, I still want movies. Most predominantly, I'm just saying that there are other avenues that they can go to create excitement about going to the movie theater. And I think by doing stuff like that, it reinvigorates people to go back to the movie theater that have become kind of taken aback from it. They don't like it. It's too expensive, blah, 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 blah. I'm like, well, it's too expensive, but you're getting a bunch of content, but you're paying $150 a month in streaming services at this point.
Yeah, and the fact that we have YouTube channels where the production quality of YouTube shows is so high quality, and the technology used to stream those shows is relatively inexpensive. There's no reason why Tina Fey and Amy Poehler were recently here in Chicago, and they did, I think it was 3 shows over the weekend, and that was it, 3 shows. Manny Patinkin was in Chicago on October 12th, and then on Saturday night. The Saturday show completely sold out. I got tickets to the Thursday show at the last minute, and was able to get like the upper two corner seats for the Manny Patinkin show. It's Manny freaking Patinkin.
Behind a post.
Right? Why isn't this being like simulcasted? Like, that's the thing. We always talked about simulcasting on this channel and simulcasting on that. Let's simulcast this stuff into the movie theaters because people can't get a ticket because it's only 2 nights.
You know, I'm relating this all to an experience I had way back in the 90s. I went to go see Korn and Rob Zombie and one other band in a stadium. And it was a free ticket that I got to go on to because a buddy of mine just happened to get tickets for the company that he was working for. And he says, you want to come? And I'm like, yeah, sure, I'll go. I mean, a free ticket to go see Korn at the time in the 90s. I really like Korn. So I go and we discovered that we had seats in a box seat area. So we had box seats. We were away from the crowd. We could still see the stage pretty well, but we also had our own private television to see what was going on directly on stage. And my God, if it wasn't one of the best shows I've ever been to, just because of the amount of comfort it was and how fun it was, and we didn't have to deal with any sort of bullshit for being on the floor. It was just being able to enjoy the live experience on a screen, but also look over and see it there in front of us. I can totally see simulcast and being able to go to a theater and enjoying that so much more than going to an actual concert.
So what were your personal biggest changes in regards to movie theaters? Like, what movies or experiences changed your perception of theaters? You know what I'm saying? Like, in terms of...
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was very, very easily the day that I was able to walk into the movie theater and actually leave the movie theater with my shoes still on my feet and not stuck to the floor, because we like moved to carpeting instead of concrete because people would just spill their drinks and gum.
That was the biggest thing for you?
Oh, my God. There was one theater that was like a budget theater, and it was so... Like, I loved going there because it was $4 for a movie. But the cleanliness of it was just so bad, and it got to a point where you couldn't even clean it up anymore. So you literally was like walking to your seat, and it's like, it was so nasty. And even now people are still nasty with whatever happens in those chairs. But the biggest thing I think is just comfortability. Like Arjan was saying, is really at the end of the day, like being able to have these like reclining chairs, sit back, relax, kind of like some people even bring blankets to the theaters now. It just let me feel like I'm at home for the next 2 hours and enjoy myself. Like, and that's why I would go to the movie theater now, because it's a bigger screen. It's a better audio experience. And I think audio is really the big thing. I remember the first time DTS came out and THX and all these sound formats. And then when Dolby Cinema hit the screen, it was like, man, in Rogue One, when those AT-AT walkers walk across the beach from one side to the other, and did it not just shake my right side of my butt cheek to my left side of my butt cheek? I was like, this is amazing.
I thought it was funny. I think the first time I went to a Dolby Cinema sound experience was with you, Troy, to see A Quiet Place.
Oh, yeah.
They didn't have theaters in my area that had it. And which is funny, because you think, well, how amazing could that be? The movie's silent. It's not. There's a lot of others. But it just amplified the silence. And it was just amazing to hear how pitch perfect all the sounds were. And then going to see a 4DX movie where it's basically a theme park ride where you're so like just between sound and those kinds of innovations, I think have really just, it's not something I need every time, but I love that they're there when I want them.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way that
for me, the big thing was the switch to stadium seating. You know, before it used to be, if you got a certain spot, you'd be able to see the screen, sure, but you'd always have somebody's head in front of you also. But when we switched over to stadium seating, that's when movie theaters really changed the most for me. I remember when we got a Movie Co. in Fort Lauderdale, that Movie Co. was my favorite place to go just because of all the stadium seating and how comfortable it was. Mm-hmm. And it was just great. And then from there, yeah, it was the recliner systems when those started becoming a thing, which was, I think, the last 5 years, recliners started becoming a thing. And again, going back to my appreciation for the concession stands when it comes to the restaurant idea of mixing a theater and a restaurant together, I love that. I just do. And I know Aaron hates it, but I love it because...
Yeah, I'm not a fan. I don't dislike it. It's just not the way I want to... Clang, 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 clang is not the way I want to enjoy a movie.
We actually had a movie theater that solved the front row problem open up here in the suburbs of Chicago.
What's the front row problem?
The front row problem is that you sit in the front row and you have to like look straight up into the sky.
Oh, they're too close.
And you literally look like a Pez dispenser because your neck is so far back. So they actually put sofa beds in the front row so that you could lay down. And that way you're not like craning your neck up like a Pez dispenser. Uh-huh. So now you can actually see the movie. And it was actually great because they actually fill all of those now because they're sofa beds.
I'm sure they do. Basic Instinct would have sold out.
Right. My theater that I go to, my favorite places to sit are in the first to second row because that's the most immersive seats in the place. And you're not running into the problem of people being in front of you because, again, stadium seating. But if you want an immersive movie experience where you practically have to turn your head, but you're comfortable at the same time, I actually like being in those rows at that theater. But if I go to a normal theater, I would not want anything to do with those.
Yeah,
I'm third row stadium seating.
I'll take the handicap seats if they're not being occupied. And then I have to sit by. I'm kidding. So I want to like kind of segue. I'm tying it into what some of the listeners commented.
I would say reserve seating. Now that you mentioned that, Aaron, reserve seating is the thing that's really the thing that really changed for me because.
I'm trying to get to reserve seating and you're cutting me off before I get there. So give me a minute and I'll get there.
It sucks, doesn't it?
Yes.
It just sucks. It sucks when he does that. You'd be in the middle of good ass thought and you're like, I'm going to totally get there. And then here comes Troy just clip clopping his fucking big ass feet into the whole that damn thing.
Breathe. Let me finish. So Jason West, we had asked people what they thought about changing, evolving movie experiences, da da da. And Jason West was talking about how he saw Top Gun Maverick a couple weeks after release. There's seven people in the theater, Fast X after 2 weeks, five other people. They said it wasn't the prices either. Tickets were $5 on Tuesday before six, unlimited popcorn and two large pops for $20. I think they screwed up when they started reserve seating. I think the future of theaters is less seats, more comfortable seating, and maybe full service food. Think restaurants surrounded by movie screens, true dinner in a movie atmosphere. Now, that's not something I want, but that is something that John wants.
I'm so with you, bro.
I don't mind having the dinner. I want the dinner before the movie, though. It's a two course thing.
Okay, so the way this place works it out is that they're taking your order way before the, even the trailers come out. Your food has been delivered to you usually by the time the first trailer comes out. You don't see a waiter anymore when the movie starts.
But I smell the food.
I mean, it's fine. Like, Alamo Drafthouse does that, and I like the way they do it. And it's not much better, but it's a little better. Probably because it's a little more ruffian. It's not so fancy. His theater is a little ridiculous. But anyway, back on topic.
I've been to his theater. It's really nice.
Yeah, it's very, very, very nice. Reserve seating. I don't like reserve seating. I do and I don't. Okay. I do like having the fact that I know there, I can go and I can sit where I want to sit. Here's what I don't like is I don't like how it's changed my theater experience because, you know, I liked getting there and getting those good seats and feeling good about it. I got here and I got them. Nobody shows up early anymore. There's never that situation where you might end up having to sit by people that really like improve your experience. I've had so many of those over the years where you see a comedy and people are just having a great time and it makes your time better. You see a superhero movie or you see something, you know, bombastic where you see little kids having a wonderful time. I don't get bothered by kids having a great time in the movie theaters. If you know it's a kid's movie, there's going to be kids. Shut up and let the kids enjoy it because you did when you were one. I get really aggravated when people are like, shut up to a kid having a great time at a movie that's obviously for families. That happens way too often. Things like that. Like there's just those kinds of things I miss. I just miss waiting in line, that communal experience, all of that. And reserve seating killed all of it. I do get the pluses, and I'm not going to say I don't love some aspects of that, but I miss the community feeling that we used to have.
I think we still have the community feel. I think the people that are diehard cinema people that book those seats and reserve seating are the diehards. They know these center seats are important. AMC knew it was so important that they even charged a buck more for them for a limited time and then changed their mind. They decide, I think that what is interesting about reserve seating is the people that don't understand the concept of reserve seating. So I know that there was a
if you tell me I don't understand the concept of reserve seating, I'm going to punch you through the microphone.
There are people that will sit in your seats. And there was actually a big news story about a gentleman who basically came up and asked a couple to move from the seats because he had those reserved seats. And then the guy like beat him down. And then went, there was a whole manhunt to go find him because he didn't understand that reserved seating is reserved seating. I like reserve seating because one, I'm an AMC A-lister. I know the procedures. I know the timing. I know that it's 25 minutes before the movie starts. I know I have to skip Nicole because I'm so freaking tired of seeing Nicole on screen. And the best thing about reserve seating is that I can buy four tickets for the two seats that I want. And mm-hmm. then when you book the two on either side, you cancel right before the show and then nobody sits next to you.
Yeah, I don't mind people sitting next to me. It doesn't bother me. Like, that's something other people get bothered by. I don't. If this a packed audience is my perfect movie, I love it. I absolutely love it. Even though you know you're going to get people on their cell phones, you know you're going to get people talking. And sometimes that happens. My God, learn to enjoy the movie sometimes. Sometimes I think people get too focused on that. Now, don't get me wrong. I get it's frustrating. But there are times where, you know, if you get an audience that's packed, usually they will shut those sons of bitches up. They will tell them to put their phones away. Like, when you have a packed audience, that stuff doesn't fly because the whole crowd of people are behind you. They want them to knock that shit off too. And I love that experience. I'll never, ever not love that experience.
This was Jason, right? Jason? Like, yeah. I agree with you. We can do something better to make the seats more comfortable and all that other stuff. The number one thing I think we can do is literally make the, you know, not even big, like TV tray. Think like a TV tray width, right? You're sitting at the TV and it's, you know, horizontal. Like that size of a TV tray, just put that. You have two seats, TV tray, two seats, TV tray, two seats, TV tray, because then you have that space to put your purse or your coat or whatever. Like that. That's the thing that there's nowhere to put your crap that you bring into
the theater. Less crap.
It's winter time in Chicago. It's cold.
Put it on your
downtown.
Lap. Jesus, you're making it this very complicated.
I sweat during the movie. It's 2.5 hours. I'm
I don't
hot.
Care.
There are some places that actually have TV trays that I've been to that aren't my fancy theater.
Sean Coates said, luxury cinemas. 10 years ago, I used to work for Sinopolis Luxury Cinemas. At the time, they were one of the first cinema chains that did the dinner and movie concept, where waitstaff would bring you food as you'd watch the movie. The theaters had recliner seats with little swivel trays for your food, along with and a call button to summon waitstaff.
Jesus Christ.
Not sure if this concept is caught on elsewhere, but here in California, they're everywhere.
That's too bad.
Yes, that has caught on for most of the country. Actually, I have a CMX now in Chicago, John.
Very nice. Those CMXs
are pretty cool. I have not gone there yet because I'm an A-list subscriber.
Yeah, that's fair also. I haven't been back to the CMX in a while.
But it is nice.
All right, Kyle Nolan, I want to mention this. So he says, one big change for me was 3D. Never saw anything in the theater back in the red-blue glasses days. Don't remember the first modern 3D movie I saw. But seeing How to Train Your Dragon in 3D IMAX while away on vacation was amazing. Another major change is the A-list, which we talked about. So 3D, I'm just curious. I know, Troy, you love Pixar animated. Do you see them in 3D when you go? Like, has that 3D, did 3D change for you at any point how you see movie theaters?
The 3D to me is about, so the gimmick of the red blue glasses era was like, oh my God, stuff's coming at me at in my face and jumping 3D. Out of the screen.
Ah!
Yeah, you know, 3D is best done when it's depth of field. So it feels like stuff is farther away. The first time you saw the Starship Enterprise in a 3D movie go to warp speed and go away from you and actually look like it went away from you, that was cool. Gravity in 3D.
Gravity in 3D.
Terrified the crap out of me. I'm never going to go to space ever again because of gravity in 3D. One,
I'm never going to go to space ever again.
Ever again.
Ever. No, never. I've been to space in my dreams. Not even going to go to space in my dreams because gravity scared the piss out of me because the 3D was so realistic feeling with the whole parachute sequence. And it was like back and forth. And like, I think where you can get depth of field in a good Pixar movie, like, well, not Pixar, because How to Train Your Dragon's DreamWorks. But things like that, where you have expansive, you know, Moana in 3D was fabulous, right? Toy Story 3 in 3D with the claw coming in the fire, fabulous, right? There's certain movies that lend itself to that aspect, but not everything has to be 3D, Kyle, just for the record.
No, not everything has to be 3D. And I'm glad that 3D is phasing out a little bit. It's not as big of a deal as it used to be. Mark Andrews says the best thing was phasing out those ridiculous midnight preview screenings and just making them after 3 p.m. on a Thursday before the release date. Ridiculous. They would think that people would want to shell out money for that. I mean, sure.
Did, though.
We totally did.
You dirty son of a bitch. Just to even say those words, that you phasing out preview screenings was cool. Shame on you. I've got so many things to say, and I could be the asshole and just be like, I mean, they had to phase them out because somebody shot up a movie theater. That's the only reason they phased them out. But I won't. I won't. You know what I'll say? I'll tell you this. I had so many fantastic experiences going to midnight show. I went and saw Grindhouse at a midnight show, and one of the best experiences of my fucking life. Saw Pirates of the Caribbean with my daughter, and there were people dressed like pirates at a midnight show. Took her out of school. Shouldn't have, but I did it. And she had a great freaking time, and she's going to remember that the rest of her life. Like, that kind of stuff, you can't replicate. You just can't. Even with the Thursday screening, I go Thursday. That's when I like to go. If it's not a critics showing or something like that, I definitely prefer to go on a Thursday night because those are my people, right? Those are the people that would have mostly been at a midnight show, but they never come out en masse like they used to for midnight screenings. So, shame on you for saying those words. I'm so mad at you right now.
Return of the King at midnight, Two Towers at midnight, still went to work afterwards. God.
Oh, Jesus.
Those are the days, right? It was better than going to work with a hangover.
Yeah, rolling in at 4 a.m. going like, that's the greatest thing I ever saw.
I gotta be up 3 hours. Jesus Christ.
But it was awesome and totally worth it.
What was I thinking? Ugh.
You were thinking of hanging out with your friends and having the best time you ever had. That's what you were thinking.
Yeah, because everybody that was there was your friend.
That's true.
That's what it felt like.
I can't remember a single midnight showing at all. So,
wow,
best time of my life.
Yeah, I guess. Dark Knight, I remember that. I very specifically remember these far more than I remember a lot of other movie screenings. Just because those were packed with people who love these things just as much as you did. They
Phantom
were
Menace.
Man, what?
Phantom Menace.
Oh, I thought you said Dennis the Menace. I'm no, like, there Phantom was no Menace. Midnight
we,
show for
we
that.
Got in line at 6 a.m. in the morning to buy tickets when the movie theater opened at noon.
I love how all your references between show. You two is Star Wars, but go ahead.
But it was the experience of the waiting in line for a big thing because you didn't have to wait in line when the other big things came out.
Sure.
But you waited in line from 6 a.m. till noon to buy the ticket, got in line at 1 o'clock for the ability to get your seat because there was no reserved seating, and you stood in line from 1 p.m. till midnight to get your seat for the midnight show.
Yeah, only suckers stood in line. I didn't stand in line for that shit.
I did. Loved standing in line. Talked about it before.
I didn't stand in line for that shit because I knew people at the movie theater. I just walked right up, got what I wanted, and bypassed the line entirely.
And this is why your bitch ass has to go to the fancy freaking movie theater, because you've been spoiled your whole life. The rest of us had to work.
Spoiled? That's not spoiled. I earned those relationships fair and fucking square.
There are people that were in that Phantom Menace line that I am still friends with today.
I'm telling you, every year when I go to South By, big reason why it's my favorite festival.
Oh, here we go with the South By story. Here
just
we go.
Listen. Bitch.
Oh, you now wait I in have
line
to listen.
It doesn't matter who you are. Everyone has to wait in line. Everyone except the stars of the movie. But everyone else, I don't care if you're press, I don't care if you're a VIP, whatever, you still have to wait outside until those doors open. And during that time, you have to have conversations with fellow film fans, just like the old days that I grew up with. And those are the best lines you're ever going to wait in your entire life, because you're there for the same thing, because you love movies. And I don't know what better experience there is.
This sounds a lot like cocaine.
It feels like cocaine. And speaking of, it's time to end this podcast. So thank you for everybody for listening. Remember, you can share your thoughts on this episode or anything else in our Facebook group, The Hollywood Outsider. You can find us on social media, whatever you want to do. Please rate and subscribe on your preferred podcast app if you like this show. If you don't like it, don't do that, because we don't want negative reviews. That sucks. And thank you, John and Troy, for joining me on this trip down memory lane. I hope everybody learned something. I know we did by researching this. The ones of us that researched it.
What's that?
Exactly. Thanks, guys. All right. Remember, the next time you head to a movie theater to see whatever it is that you want to see, buy popcorn. I didn't mention the couch, because this is all about movie theater.
Exactly. I was going to say, like, don't say the couch. This is a movie theater.
I was right there. I'm like, I remember when I expanded that and it broke my heart, but I don't have to for this one. My popcorn.
It broke your heart a little bit. You were never the same.
I died inside.
Or pretzel sticks or chicken wings or whatever else. Icings.
Burgers. Root beer floats.
What's your standard? Whenever you go to a movie theater, we get a pizza, popcorn, and a pop. What do you get?
That's so much food.
That is a lot of
food. It's usually dinner for us. Like, that's our dinner.
I usually get Twizzlers or Reese's Pieces, and then a not a pop. I do the sparkling waters that the ahas.
Oh, Jesus Christ. You're way too fancy for me.
No, that's not fancy. It's just not soda.
It just sounds fancy.
Kids Pack is the best deal in the house. Popcorn drink and a fruit snack for $8.
I don't understand. Always taking like the cheapest deal you can find. Maybe that's how you have like a life savings.
Here's why you buy the Kids Pack, because the Kids Pack comes in a box, and then you can take your popcorn and you can pour it into the box and pour all the butter and salt on it that you want and shake it up the way it's supposed to be done, not just the friggin' top layer of the giant large popcorn.
Go with me. I'll show you how you can do this without having to do that nasty straw gimmick, and you just got to get it down.
I go with somebody who. He goes and says, okay, I want a large popcorn. They say, great. And they start filling it up. He's like, oh, whoa, one scoop. And they go, okay. They hand him this popcorn with one scoop. He runs over to the butter machine, loads it up with butter. He runs back. He goes, okay, another couple of scoops. And then, he goes and back and forth like that the entire way.
Okay, that guy's an asshole. So is this the same guy that is okay looking at his phone during the movie?
Yeah, I can't comment on that anymore.
God damn it. I can't see a movie with him ever, just so you know.
The butter should be at the counter and not someplace else. It slows the whole process down.
Well, I just don't understand why you need that much butter, but that's just me.
Yeah.
Although he picks
butter, by the way.
Yeah, it's not butter. It's just oil.
I can't believe it's seen as butter.
It's butter if you went to the Arclight, which doesn't exist anymore.
Okay, we got to go. Bye.